As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
A United Nations Security Council resolution passed in February of 1961, following the murder of Congolese Premier Patrice Lumumba, was to have severe repercussions for a company of Irish troops in the Congo later that year. The resolution urged the UN to take immediately all appropriate measures to prevent the occurrence of civil war in the Congo and authorise the use of force as a last resort. This is the story of the effects of the implementation of this resolution. The story of A Company, 35th Battalion, Western Command, more than 150 Irishmen, located at the outpost of Jataville in September 1961, which came under sustained attack from the Katanganese forces and was forced to surrender. The only company of troops in the history of the Irish Defence Forces ever to be left in such an isolated and unenviable position. Three officers, Joe Leach, Liam Donnelly and Noel Carey, and four men, Peter O'Callaghan, Bill Reedy, Tom Cunningham and Bob Allen, were all at Jataville and recalled the experience. Another officer and academic, Terry O'Neill, who also served in the Congo, has researched the event from the initial resolution to its effects today and at the time.
At the time, morale in the army was low, numbers were low, there was a rather depressing scene in the country, and we weren't really sure of where we were going, and all of a sudden we were plunged into this particular operation without any idea of what we were supposed to be doing or how we were to do it.
There was enormous enthusiasm for their chaps going out to right all wrongs in the world, but those were flavoured with the sight of the Niemba funeral in Dublin, where the chaps who were killed at the Niemba ambush had literally a state funeral.
Well, I think few people have adequate conception of the enormous size of the Congo, which covers over 900,000 square miles. I mean, this is a frightening number. But to give you a fair idea of the size of it, placed on a map of Europe, the Congo stretches from Paris to Riga, from Riga to Athens, and from Athens back again to Paris. It is 77 times the size of Belgium, or the size of Western Europe. It was a country of 16 million people, roughly, of whom in 1961 only perhaps 60,000 were Europeans.
Just a couple of days after the Congo had got independence in June 1960, law and order broke down. The army mutinied and there was widespread violence. Many of the Belgians who were there prior to independence had fled, and Belgian government reacted by sending in paratroopers to protect their citizens. And at pretty much the same time, the province of Katanga in the southeast declared itself independent. And this was highly significant for a couple of reasons. The first being that it was perceived to generate something like 50 to 55% of the state revenue. And that came largely from the copper mines in the south of the province. And these were controlled by a giant conglomerate called Union Minière, which was largely controlled by British, French and Belgian interests. And the second point was that there was widespread fear that if Katanga was allowed to secede, this would set a dangerous precedent that all the newly independent countries in Africa and elsewhere, and the ones that were about to become independent, would do likewise, and it was feared that this would have very dangerous consequences. So there was particular interest in the Congo and in Katanga's secession for that reason.
Well, when things back about then, that time, very few of those chaps who went out in the Western Command Company, so there would have been people from Galway as well, right? Very few of those people had been literally outside the country. And I'd say 99.9 repeating had never been on an aeroplane in their lives.
We had never seen planes like this before, which took the whole platoon, plus armoured cars and supplies. And we flew out, landed in Malta, overnighted in Malta, moved on from there to Huilas Air Base in Libya, where we stayed for 2 days. Actually, when we landed, the American troops were sure that we were actually Koreans because they had never seen anything like the soldiery. We were actually landing in North Africa, temperature in the 90s, and you can imagine, well, maybe you can't, but at the time we wore bull's wool uniforms. We wore greyback, which was the First World War vintage. Soldiers had their numbers tattooed in the front of the greyback. We wore brown leggings and brown boots, peat caps, and you can imagine what that was like travelling around or walking around in temperatures of 90 degrees.
Well, when we got there, we arrived in a place called Leopoldville, and we were sent to a transit camp. We were in this transit camp, and oh God almighty, with big bull's wool on us, up to the neck buttons, and a big peat cap, and it was as heavy as the uniform we were wearing, and the sweat coming peeling down off our foreheads. It was brutal. And mosquitoes all round us, eating the lard out of us. That's the truth.
Well, as far as we were concerned, most of our activity was around Elizabethville itself, which is, looked like a modern European city. It was built in 1910 out of the bush, and it was a lovely place to be, at least it was when we arrived there. There were towns which we got to know later on, places like Jadaville, which is roughly 90 miles out of Elizabeth, which was roughly, say, from Dublin to Athlone. That'll give you an idea. And I suppose this was the only road north out of Elizabethville for 90 miles or further on up to Colwazy that was tarmacadamed. But outside of that, there was no roads. It was all pathways and rough bush and things like that.
I was volunteered to go to Dilolo on a patrol, the object being to bring a minister's wife and his family back to Elizabethville for a relay up to Leopoldville. And this was a journey of 315 miles, through half of it through good roads, the other half through the bush. Indeed, we lost an armour car and a truck on the way. And on the way back, we actually travelled through Jadaville and Colwazy. At Jadaville, we were stopped. I happened to be in the front vehicle with our interpreter. We made our way up to a mercenary officer, a Belgian mercenary officer, and he told us that we couldn't go through. So after telling him that we were only on a mercy mission, we were allowed to go through, but it was obvious that the whole area of the Lufira Bridge was well manned. We could see troops dug in on both sides. We arrived back at Elizabethville to be told the following morning at 4 o'clock we were heading to the gendarme headquarters, and the idea was that we would take over the headquarters, that's A Company, and my platoon were to surround the building, block off all the roads. All mercenary, mainly white officers, coming in were to be arrested, and the UN then decided that they were going to transfer those officers out of Katanga and back to where they came from, mainly Belgium.
That was August 28th, 1961, when Conor Cruise O'Brien, then the UN Secretary General's special representative in Katanga, was among those who launched the operation known as Rum Punch. Its follow-up, Operation Mortar, on September 13th, has been described by Terry O'Neill as a high-risk venture, and the risk was certainly high for the Irish company now stationed at Jataville.
Well, Jataville came about initially when we heard about it. We were surprised at A company, because B company had been detailed to go out there with a force called Force Meade. This Force Meade was a combination of the Irish company and the Swedish company. And they went out there to safeguard the white population and to bring them to safety if anything had happened. And after the few days that they were out there, the Swedish commander, Meade, couldn't see any reason why he was out there. The whites told him they didn't want him. So he had no purpose to the mission in which he was given. So he came back with his force to Elizabethville and said, listen, that mission that I got doesn't hold together. So I brought all my troops back. It's too far out and too cut off. So he came back, and within 2 days, A Company were detailed to go out to Jataville, and without any written operational instruction, verbally at all, to go out to Jataville to be there to protect the white population.
It's significant because what happened there shouldn't have happened, and it highlights the problems created by giving troops an uncertain mission and of assigning personnel who aren't equipped for combat, a combat task. And the use of force arose from the February 61 resolution, which was passed by the Security Council after the death of Patrice Lumumba, or more correctly, the murder of Patrice Lumumba. This was a highly controversial resolution for two reasons. First of all, there was the reference to use of force to prevent civil war. But civil war is an internal matter. And Hammarskjöld, from the outside, had declared that the UN force would not intervene in the Congo's internal affairs. Moreover, some participating states, Ireland, Sweden, Ethiopia and Tunisia, had early on indicated that they did not want their personnel involved in any internal dispute in the Congo. Second, the reference to use of force raised several problems. There was the issue, and is always the issue, of how much force was to be used and to what end, and who was to decide. There was certain to be a significant difference between the use of force as interpreted by different contingents. Some would likely act with considerable aggression, others with restraint. This would inevitably create tensions within the force. Also, there would be the problems for contingent commanders on the issue of casualties. Commanders would inevitably be conscious of how home governments and the relatives of personnel involved would not want their personnel to be killed in some faraway place in a dispute about which they knew very little and cared very little. I've sought to get information on the precise reasons why it was sent there, and they're not at all clear from any of the sources I've tried. The personnel who went there were told that they were sent on the instructions of New York at the request of Paul-Henri Spaak, the Belgian foreign minister, who claimed that there was the possibility of attacks upon the white population in Jataville. But this wasn't really a likely event.
The whites didn't want us at all. They were very upset by our presence. They thought they were only going to bring trouble into their lives being out there. So once again, we couldn't understand. Like Meade, we couldn't understand why we were out there. And this was reported back by the officer commanding A Company, Pat Quindlen, that this was the situation in which he found himself in. And should he return or to stay there, and was he going to get a written direction? He was told to stay there to defend the white population if they were attacked, and he never got any written instruction of what to do.
And it fell to my lot to be first in, because it was number one platoon. And when we discovered that our transport, but we didn't discover, we knew damn well that unless we got a lot more transport, we just wouldn't be moving. And they scraped up a few things. And I know I packed up my entire platoon into a Bedford, an old Bedford lorry. Not unlike the ones we had at home, except it had a place for an observer over the driver's cab for firing an automatic weapon. Next we had to leave, because of lack of the transport, we had to leave behind the most vital thing, as far as we were concerned, our 81mm mortars and ammunition and a 10-day ration, pack rations for emergency. No, that couldn't come. We dragged a little 60mm mortars with us and the Carl Gustav purple platoon, and jolly old, literally the Vickers is a First World War water-cooled machine. They were great old things. But showing a sign of the rage, you know. And the irony of the whole damn thing is when, as I said, with number one platoon, when we were going in, I met the last people from B Company coming out of Jadeville. And I wondered, and I wondered. And I wished them good luck and hope for the same for ourselves.
Jadeville was part of what was known as the Copper Belt, which bestrode South Katanga and Northern Rhodesia, as it then was, Zambia now. And there was considerable link between those two areas, tribal personnel, but more significantly, there was this huge presence of copper. There were also other minerals in that area. There was the uranium, which the Americans had employed in the bombs used at Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Well, there were some problems we had going out there that I think should be related. First of all, we had no transport. The only transport we got was sufficient transport to bring the men, their personal weapons and some ammunition out. There was American emergency rations, which we should have had. There wasn't enough of transport to get those out. We were told the transport would be supplied a few days later to bring that out. That never came to us. We were left out there with one truck, one saloon, and two armoured cars. And that was what we found ourselves with, 90 miles from base.
As soon as we got there, it was on a Sunday, Monday morning, we kind of reorganised, got ourselves, the company commander got the platoons organised, and very shortly after that I remember heading into the city or the town of Jadeville itself with CQMS Paddy Neville. It was a mining town, very much like what you would see in some of the American films, a lot of adobe kind of buildings there. But outside of that, up towards Union Minière, which was the mining company, you had the native shacks strewn all over the hillside.
The next day, Pat Quinlan came to me and his wonderfully rich Kerry accent said, "Joe," he said, "you will go and show the flag." And I said, "I will show what, sir?" He said, "You'll go and show the flag. That's what the UN is here for." So I said, "Sir," climbed into my machines, maybe two machines actually, and off we went. And went through Jadeville and got a rather mixed reception, went further down the road, quite a few miles, and came to another of these blessed bridges with a small guard of gendarmerie on it. And I saw that things could be critical. So we drove on another spot or two, and at this stage I decided that the best thing to do would be to turn about, and back across the bridge, which we did. And I said to the platoon, "Now look, fellas, we're going across this bridge fast." And we did.
Pat Quinlan decided that rather than dealing with radio messages, that somebody would have to go into Elizabethville and explain the situation at Jadeville in order to get the thing revised or give us support or do something. So the doctor, Dr. Commandant Sloan, and myself were permitted by the opposing force to go by saloon into Elizabethville on the pretext that we were injured and that the doctor was coming with us. So when I went into Elizabethville, I met the officer commanding the battalion at the officer's mess in Elizabethville, and at the same time Mr. O'Brien was attending a function there, and I passed on all the message that I was given by my commanding officer Pat Quinlan to say that we were surrounded, that we had very little food, we had very little water, we had no supplies, no big supply of arms and ammunition, And it was a very delicate situation for us to be in. I was requested by Commandant Quinlan to request either that he would remove himself out of Jadaville and get back to Elizabethville if we could, or that he would be given reinforcements. So that night I was told to go to bed and that reinforcements would be available for me in the morning. And when I got up in the morning, there was no reinforcements. I was told, you'll have a choice. You can stay where you are or you can go back into Jadaville. So I had troops that I was in command of back at Jadaville, and I decided that I was going back in. So I was brought back to the Lefero Bridge under escort from a platoon under Lieutenant Mick Shannon, and we shook hands and said goodbye at the Lefero Bridge. Well, the Lefero Bridge was kind of the only kind of natural obstacle, if you like, between Elizabethville and Jadaville. It was about maybe 12 to 18 miles out of Jadaville. It was a very long ravine, and this bridge covered the ravine, and it was manned as when I went into Elizabethville that time, and on my journey back, it was strongly manned by the gendarmerie, and they had roadblocks up, and it was a very difficult position from a military point of view.
Then on Tuesday night of the 12th of September, I was orderly officer. And early on that morning, I got a call at 7 o'clock from UN headquarters to state that Operation Mortar had taken place in the city, that the UN had secured all the installations, that the operation had been a major success, and to inform Commandant Quinlan.
That was absolutely crucial, because we didn't know, you see, that this Operation Mortar was to come about on the 13th of September. And when our position was rushed by the opposing forces on that morning, luckily enough, our company had been dug in. There was people in every trench. We repulsed that early attack, and only for Commandant Quinlan's fortitude and planning, we could have been overrun that morning.
I was getting going off for my breakfast, and somebody shouted, it was one of the sentries that was on duty outside the villa, that there was an attack. You could see them coming from all directions. Then when I looked around, we could see them come from all directions. There was a big golf links behind us. You could see them coming across the golf links and everything, down by the hedgerows and what have you. So we immediately took to the trenches. The trenches were down. Coming and Quinlan, one great man. It was the greatest thing he did, as a matter of fact.
These chaps were coming back from shaving and washing, not being that mass, let me say. And they had on them singlets with the towels around their neck, sort of thing. And they saw a movement the other side of the road, and about 30 of the gendarmerie rushed across the road at the vicar's. The vicar's was sandbagged but unattended. And the two boys, the sergeants Kelly and Monaghan, dropped down behind it and let fly. And they cut down that attack party.
It was of the 13th of September that I can remember, that early in the morning. And we used to have mass in the mornings. So we were on our way to mass. Most of them were gone to mass, but myself and two other men were a bit late. And lucky enough we were, because just as we were leaving where we were staying, the Congolese had entered our compound. Armed, heavily armed. And we had a Willys Jeep outside of our billet with a Vickers submachine gun mounted. So one of the men that was with me, was a sergeant at the time, jumped up on the Willys Jeep and fired the Vickers submachine gun into the air. Now, not at the Congolese, into the air, and they all retreated because they understood that our compound was empty. We were all at mass. They were getting information. But they were surprised to find somebody there, and they retreated. And it was a couple of hours after then that the actual firing and started. You know, I had personal experience, because Unfortunately, the trench that I dug for myself was occupied when the firing did break out, and there was a bit of confusion, so I was kind of left in the open. And I know, having been reminded of it now, that we were looking down onto a golf course. No, I had forgotten that, but we're looking onto a golf course defending that area when I was happened to be shot. But I got leg injuries. I was shot through the left thigh. And lucky enough, the bullet went through, went up across my stomach, and pierced a small piece of my stomach and straight out. So I was lucky enough.
Colonel Quinlan gave me orders to alert the troops. I got into a jeep, drove to a support platoon. Just as I arrived at support platoon area, the Katangese fully armed troops were disembarking from trucks which were pulled in just across the road. I shouted at them, and they were already moving into position. I drove further back down the road, and number one platoon were just getting ready to attend mass. I roared at them that we had problems and to man their positions. I drove down back towards Perfina. As I was driving, a number of shots rang out, and this was the first really scary moment, because were they firing at me, or who were they firing at?
Next thing, the fighting broke out and went on with heavy fighting, and the only thing that was really hampering us was the jet they had. They had the power in the sky where we had nothing, you see, and he could come in and bomb us and strafe us and all that.
The firing lasted for maybe 2 hours, then gradually died down. You can imagine in the Congo, it's darkness, dusk comes in about 5:30, and it gets dark at 6 o'clock. So at 6 o'clock, we were still waiting for our relief column to arrive, and there was no sign of them. And then we said, well, maybe they're waiting for first light to come through. Commander Quinlan sent word to the company through the platoon commanders to have a meeting with him at his headquarters, which he had moved to one of the villas close by. At that meeting, he told us that the column, the relief column, had gone back to Elizabethville. I suppose the sense of shock was just, you know, unbelievable. How could they have gone back? We couldn't believe that they actually left us in the lurch.
On the road and at the corner of our joint platoon areas was a termite mound, and that was cut away, and he caused a Vickers to be planted halfway up the bloody anthill because it could command the road both ways, and it was very effective. And with the advent of the Fuga, we felt rather vulnerable because, as I said, we were much more compact than we had been. And one of its sorties, it came across and let fly its little bombs right at the anthill, trying obviously to take out the Vickers. They were a little bit out. But one of the effects they had was to literally bury a man in a weapons pit. And we dug out the chap, and one of the men digging him out was a Sergeant Monaghan. And I saw the boy, and I mean boy, he was in extraordinary shock, that's all I can say. He wasn't speaking, and, oh, you know what I mean, shock, shock, shock. And he was in a badly shocked if he was dug out of a something that's a bomb or that's buried you in, or an earthquake or something, and it isn't good for the nerves. And I went off to about my own business, and I said, Sergeant, I said, will you keep an eye on him? He said, he's not very good now. Take him to the doctor. And he did. But the strange thing is that he was so good to him. And mind you, Monaghan was a tough man, is a tough man, I haven't still. But he had this wonderful feeling for people that he cured that boy. He brought him back to some degree of normality, I say, within 48 hours. Mind you, the lad followed him around like a pet dog, I suppose, for the rest of the time we were in the Congo.
I would go on to say that perhaps the number of the imposing force who were killed in Operation Jadeville is something that somebody should be aware of. They ran into hundreds, and we weren't there in the Congo for this kind of thing, unless it was absolutely necessary in a full-blown war. And it was something we had to be mindful of. If this continued on, there was just going to be more killing of the opposing force, because we were well dug in, and our problem was we had no running. We were running out of ammunition and we were running out of food.
It was rough. Now, 6 days and five nights non-stop without a sleep or a bit to eat.
Stu, I remember Jack Prendergast. What a great man. There's no doubt about it. A man who was in any other army, he'd be a lieutenant now. He'd end up a captain, I suppose. He'd be decorated. The man, I seen him going around with a teaspoon. A whole platoon of us. Now, don't take any more than a teaspoonful of that, Stu. That's all we were allowed to take. Just to keep it, to keep our lips, you know, from being parched or whatever. It was the evening time we'd done this, the night.
Well, the following days we were constantly under attack. We repulsed each attack, and when the attacks were repulsed, they got in further reinforcements. And it was estimated at some stage that there was 3,000 to 5,000 of opposing forces of one nature or another surrounding the position and firing at us. During this time, there were two attempts made by forces, UN forces, to relieve us. But they got as far as the Lafeyra Bridge each time, and each time they were beaten back. So that was a big disappointment to us. But coming towards the 16th, 15th and 16th, there was messages coming back from Elizabethville by radio to us that there were negotiations about ceasefire, and they were at a very delicate level, so that this arranging of a ceasefire was going on at Elizabethville. And on the 15th and 16th, the opposing forces looked for a ceasefire at Jadaville as well. So our commander, Quindon, seeing that there was ceasefire negotiations going on in Elizabethville, when they were sought at Jadaville, he decided that he would speak to the opposing forces and see what this was all about. So that's how we came across about talking about a ceasefire.
The terms of the ceasefire were laid down and made out in writing, and it consisted of a number of paragraphs, mainly that the ceasefire would be put into effect immediately, that the Fuga jet would be grounded, that firing be stopped at the Lafeyra Bridge, that no Katangan troops were to advance on our positions, that a joint patrol of Irish and Katangan troops was to occupy no man's land, that a cordon of unarmed police were to prevent sightseers coming onto the site, and the gendarmes were to withdraw to barracks. Water was to be turned on, and the police chief was to patrol the native village and assure the natives that all was well. At a subsequent meeting that Sunday afternoon, Manungo laid down that the Irish troops had acquitted themselves well. He complained about the actions of the Indian troops in Elizabethville, and then he said that the Irish troops would have to surrender immediately. We would have to stack our weapons, move out of our positions, and be ready to be taken as prisoners back into Jadotville. Commandant Quinlan, having discussed the matter with battalion headquarters and been told that there were UN aircraft on the way, which was a lie, and also been told that the relief column would come back, which was equally untrue, and having found himself in virtually an impossible position, stated that he would almost certainly have to surrender. Whereupon he got a message from the battalion headquarters to say, "On will to Eg Tregant Navarre," in other words, "Are you deserting your men?" For a brave, a courageous and gallant army officer and commander as Commandant Quinlan was, this was a complete slap in the face and almost totally demoralised the man. Lucky for us, he soon retained his composure, and reluctantly he had to go back to Manungo and accept the terms, which were that we would leave our weaponry, hand it over to the Katangans, move into Jadotville as prisoners.
It was strange. The Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation published, while we're, the fighting was still in progress, and they published a broadcast saying, "The Irish company at Jadotville has been overrun. There is no account of casualties." Huh? Now, that was rebroadcast, I think, on the BBC and in some papers. Now, I'm not saying the Irish papers were involved in it, but I think some of the papers that would be read in Ireland had it.
It was one of the unique situations. As prisoners in Jadotville, and in September, We actually were sitting in our room, well, in our room one night, listening to an All-Ireland final. Probably the only thing we were wondering was, should somebody have mentioned the fact in Croke Park that we were actually prisoners in Janetville at the time?
We never realised until much later that some of them are 15 and a half. My own Batman orderly, Jimmy Redmond, he's a Crook corporal afterwards. Great chap, great bit of stuff. And he was wounded in the December fighting. But he, I discovered, was 15 and a half. The lad who was buried in the weapons pit, he was 15 and a half. And there was a third one. Years and years later, the man was a CQMS at the time, and he came to me and he says, "Sir, I've got a bit of a problem." I said, "What is it?" He said, "It's about age." I said, "We all grow old," facetiously. "I know," he said, "I want to grow old." "Oh, God," I said, "it's your bloody birth cert, is it?" He said, "Yeah." So we got him to a commission of the peace, and he was adjusted. He was 16. He was the ripe age of 16, and he was a topper. And I think the only reliable information that came back was stuff that came back from officers and NCOs, men who sent back letters with a Red Cross visitation. And I know, for my own part, I would split it, and it was only the one letter, actually. The first part would be for family, and the other would be any information that we had about conditions of people, conditions of living, and so on. And prospects, too, of course, yes.
This went on for 4 weeks. The upturn of it was that there was an agreement signed by Chombe that there would be a ceasefire, and part of the ceasefire thing there would be an exchange of prisoners, because there was Kenningese prisoners retained as well by the UN. Chombe agreed that there would be an agreement and there'd be an exchange of prisoners, and eventually this did happen, and at the old airfield in Elizabethville we were handed back to our own people, and the Kenningese prisoners were handed back to theirs. Well, I suppose, to be fair to say, in the first few days that there was confused thinking, because nobody knew exactly what had happened at Janetville. Nobody knew the amount of fighting and the bravery that was shown there. And I think there was some elements of our own forces who thought that this surrender should never have happened. But you had to be there to realise the situation. And I'm proud with all of the people that were there. And I've nothing but praise for my commander. And in the manner in which we were left without orders and without support, I think that the company at Janetville did a splendid job.
Almost 43 years on, and those who served the UN and Ireland in Janetville in 1961 have questions left unanswered. Who took the decision to send them there? Why were they not supported? Why was no one honoured or mentioned for their role at Janetville? And why was Janetville almost airbrushed from Irish military history? Was it to protect some person or organisation? Was it because the company inflicted so many fatalities on the Katanganese? Or was it because the company was forced to surrender?
I'm aware that many of the people who were taken prisoner there felt very angry at the fact that they had been put into such an exposed position and given very little opportunity of getting out, and that when they surrendered, they were perceived to have done so on for very flimsy reasons. Their feeling, as expressed to me by a few, was that they were let down and that nobody ever explained why they were there, and nobody ever attempted to justify to them their presence or the failure to take them out at an earlier stage.
One always knew that there was maybe a question mark among certain people. Why did they have to? Until after a while, they learned why. A lot of them had their nose rubbed in at the poor devils, because they had been at the bridge and knew what that tiny thing was. And it didn't compare with being stuck for a week under the Fuga and company.
However, in the case of the army authorities themselves, I don't think they are blameless in that there was never an inquiry held. There was never a question of any of our any officer that was there giving a report. In fact, it was frowned on to even mention the Jadotville. And the sad thing of all was that no officer in Jadotville was ever recognised for the heroic actions. And indeed, I'm quite aware that a number of them were recommended for awards, none of which ever took place.
Nobody wanted to know at the time, and nobody wants to know about it since. In order to cover up, I suppose, the problems at the higher level, I suppose Jadotville could have been the one to blame. It was an easy one to blame for what happened.
I don't know that the UN knew where they were going. Nowadays you hear a lot about peace enforcement. We were told it was peacekeeping. Do they know what peace enforcement is now? What happened to the Dutch troops in over there in Middle Europe? They, poor devils, they were left in the lurch there. But certainly the position they were put in by the UN was unforgivable. And the UN must have known that things like that had happened before. They must have known about Jadotville, but they didn't want to know about Jadotville. Because it would have been egg on too many, both military and civilian faces in the UN.
The outstanding lesson, is that those responsible for authorising operations, that is the members of the Security Council, and those responsible for the conduct of operations, that is the UN Secretariat, should refrain from the use of the term use of force in relation to peacekeeping operations, or at least use it with great care, giving full consideration to the possible consequences. Jadotville highlighted the problems which can arise when the Security Council and the Secretariat fail to distinguish between peacekeepers and conventional military forces.
If you enjoyed this documentary, you might like to listen to our other Documentary on One productions. Visit rte.ie/docon1.